Hello, everybody. Welcome to Tamara Lee's Trend On, engaging your audience to trend on you, live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Central Time. Trend On, featuring guest interviews and current trends from businesses to entertainment to lifestyle topics. And here's your host, the engaging Tamara Lee.
Good morning. Welcome to Tamara Lee's Trend On, engaging your audience to trend on you. I am your host, Tamara Lee, founder of Tamara Lee LLC, a communications expertise company, meeting the needs of clients on multiple communications platforms from mobile, social, and content to image and style consulting. And you can find me at Tamara Lee, LLC, TamaraLeeGh, LLC.com. I want to thank you for joining us this morning, along with my co-host there, Heidi Feimster, on the Link Local Network. And we have a great show coming up, a part two of our conversation last week. If you missed that, you can check out the link and listen to our first conversation with mediation expert Judith Weigel of Divorce Resources out of Los Angeles, California. And it was a great conversation that we had last week talking about mediation in general, conflict resolution, how to get two seemingly opposing parties with different needs and issues to come together in a collaborative conflict resolution rather than putting on the boxing gloves and duking it out. So today we are going to continue that conversation, as I said, with Judith Weigel, and part two, focusing specifically on divorce and finding out, are divorce wars inevitable, or is there a better way to go about it? I have to believe, in talking with some of my attorney friends in the divorce specialist field, that the economic downturn, as tends to happen, has actually seen a decrease in divorce because people simply can't afford it, or the housing market, they're upside down in their mortgage and they can't, you know, really divide any assets yet. So in light of that, people have had to come up with some creative solutions and how to live in maybe less than love and happily ever after relationships. So mediation and divorce resources offers a practical alternative to couples that don't want to or maybe cannot invest a lot of their resources into getting divorced. So we look forward to that conversation with our guest Judith Weigel in a moment here. Before we get to that, I should also say that you can find us on Link Local Network, and Heidi, my co-host, is the producer and tech-savvy gal at managing partner at Manditech LLC, and you can connect with both Heidi and myself on LinkedIn, Google+, Facebook, and on the linklocalnetwork.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Tamara Lee LLC, at Heidi Feimster, and at the Linked Local Net. So, Heidi, do you have a shout-out to our sponsors here at the top of our show?
I do, Tamara. We'd like to thank Mediavine Marketing, simplifying social media for successful businesses and professionals through training, consulting, and management. Mediavine Marketing, minimizing your efforts and maximizing your results. We'd also like to thank Manditech, the Chicago area technology company that has the right solution for your business, increasing your visibility and profit with technology. We'd also like to thank ZipBoss.com, a professional business cloud built and maintained by Metasoft, Inc. ZipBoss, create, market, succeed. More powerful websites are born. Thank you, Tamara.
Thank you, Heidi. And Tamara Lee's Trend On is one of several shows in the lineup of the Link Local Network, so check out those other shows as well. We have some great show hosts, great content on the LinkedLocalNetwork.com. Linked Local Network is a networking organization for professionals who utilize social media to promote their businesses and accomplish their goals. With a strong local, national, and international following, you can link locally, connect globally at LinkLocalNetwork.com. And as I mentioned today, you can find our show link as well as last week's and other past Tamara Lee Trend On shows on my blog post, on my website, Tamara Lee LLC, as well as on the Link Local website under radio show. So all of that business out of the way, I am excited to bring back just a fabulous guest, Judith Weigel, as I said, out of Los Angeles Divorce Resources. And Judith has such a wealth of knowledge and information, I thought, you know, there really is two parts. We did the overview of mediation and conflict resolution last week, and now I'm excited to bring her back on this week and talk specifically about divorce and conflict resolution through mediation rather than divorce court. So welcome, Judy. Thank you for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me back, Tamara.
Well, we are delighted to have you. As I said, you know, everybody, I think, thinks with L.A., it's like a revolving door on the marriage license and divorce court.
And then, well, our divorces just get publicized more than other people's divorces, that's all.
I think that's true. Probably no more or less out there. It's just that's what hits the paper. So thank goodness we can live in other parts of the world and be a little bit more obscure with our...
So true. We've got Khloe Kardashian on the news, don't we? Getting her divorce.
Who?
Khloe Kardashian, Kim Kardashian's sister.
Oh, my gosh.
Listen, I keep up with the Kardashians. I have to. They get divorced a lot. I need to know what's going on.
I know. You almost have to color code each one and like, you know, get some kind of game board out there.
Too funny. The Kardashians' issues are no different than everybody else's issues when they get divorced. You know, what are the things that cause divorce? Money. First and foremost, money and people's positions on money, their ability to deal with money, and then adultery comes second. And through all of that, communication is the culprit. Isn't that funny? That's your link. In any issue, is communication is the culprit. And the most difficult thing about getting divorced, obviously, is the communication has broken down. But what's the thing that's going to make your divorce better than it can be otherwise? Communication skills. It just keeps coming back to that one thing, communication.
And so
how do we deal with
that? How do you take that when you've got clients who are, I mean, obviously they're in those spots because they haven't communicated well, and to try and work through a process where they either don't like each other, they may hate each other, there's all this mix of emotion. How do you get them worked through that process to where you can, you know, be grown-ups about it and just get the emotion out of the way?
Well, a couple different things. Anybody who works in the business, whether they're a mediator, an attorney, doesn't matter what you do, every single person in the business, I think, has a responsibility to explain to people that at least while they're going through the divorce process, they absolutely have to step up their game on communication, or they're going to spend unbelievable amounts of money getting divorced, and it's so unnecessary to do. So I think we all bear a responsibility to the divorcing public to show them how to behave through the process. Now, I mean, it's easier said than done, obviously. So here's
right.
what I say to my clients. When they come in the office, first thing I ask is, well, even on the phone before they come in the office, are you communicating? Are you able to have conversations with each other? Even if you disagree and argue, are you at least able to get through a conversation? If they say, no, we really can't, then what I do when I bring them in for mediation is I show them exactly what it's like to communicate in a different way. And so we go back to the basics. A, stop blaming the other person. It doesn't matter how bad they are. What matters is that you deal with the process of divorce in the best way possible. So you have to put all those charges down. You're going to deal with them emotionally later on, without a doubt, but you do have to put it aside in order to make your deals with each other, because that's what divorce is. It's a negotiation. It's a negotiation about money, and it's a negotiation about property. It's a negotiation about debt, and it's a negotiation about your children, which, of course, are your most precious assets. So the first thing we have to explain to people is it doesn't matter what the other person did wrong. And let's just say the other person was the worst person known to mankind for conversation's sake. It still doesn't matter anymore. What matters is if you want to get what you want out of the divorce, out of the division of property, you seldom are going to do it by bludgeoning the other person, unless you have unbelievable amounts of money to spend and you want to go to court and you delight in spending that money to bludgeon the other person. If that's where you're at, well, then there's nothing we can do to help you. This goes out to the bulk of the people who don't have unlimited resources to spend on attorneys, but who need to do the best they can for themselves leaving the divorce. So that's it. Number one, stop bludgeoning the other person. Number two, stop playing the victim. Because you have to mentally position yourself so that the words that come out of your mouth are appropriate words. Let's just say that you're getting divorced and you're completely shocked. You had no idea there were all these other affairs. You had no idea there were these other bank accounts. You had no idea. You know what? I don't believe it. I don't believe there were no telltale signs. What I do see is that people kid themselves into accepting the relationships that they have that eventually go bad, and therefore you want to say how shocked you are. But you know, Tamara, how many people have we all talked to that saw signs before they even got married that there was something amiss? And what we do is try and make it better, right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, my
so
daughter was fine. Say that on air. Okay,
yeah, well.
I know.
Yeah, and signs are there. I mean, there's even an author of a book. What's his name? His name is Gary. I'm actually looking. Oh, Gavin De Becker. Gavin De Becker wrote a fabulous book called The Gift of Fear. And what he said was, if you just listen to yourselves, if you listen or look for those telltale signs in your stomach that tell you something isn't right about a situation, you will more than likely make the better decisions for yourselves. But how many couples come in here and say, you know what, my dad, my mom said I shouldn't have married so-and-so. They saw the signs that I didn't see. So stop playing the victim. You're here. There's a reason why you're here. Now make it the best transition in your life possible. So I guess that's another thing. You know, the way you view divorce, you know, I try and ask the couples who come here to look at it as a transition instead of the worst thing that ever happened to you. Because if you look at things more positively, if you accept the responsibility of your actions that you are in a situation going through transition, again, it sets you up to communicate differently. Okay, now let's do the hardcore communication part. Now that we've done the philosophical background, now that we've done the mental positioning, now let's look at literally, logistically, how do you make different words come out of your mouth? Well, with every couple, they either both jab at each other or only one jabs and the other one remains silent and fumes, and maybe they explode later. So let's look at the couple where one person jabs more than the other person. One person puts the other person down more than their mate. The first thing I tell the people who are less vocal and don't do a lot of jabbing, you don't have to engage. Just because somebody says something mean and awful to you, you're not required to respond. And if you stop responding or just say things like, I understand, okay, I hear you, what's the other person going to come back with? Eventually, nothing. So don't engage. Let the other person go on and say what they want to say and be horrible and miserable, because what's going to happen is that person's words will ring back to him or her. And eventually, as mean and awful as you think your spouse is, you're going to start seeing some change. Because if all you're confronted with is your own bad language and your own bad and mean communication style, you're going to stop and listen, or you're going to say, well, why aren't you talking? Well, I don't have anything really to say. I guess I don't feel I'm a bad parent, and I guess I don't agree with what you're saying, but you're entitled to your own feelings. I mean, listen to that. Think about that as a response to, what do you mean? I never did that. You're horrible. Look at what you did. I mean, what a difference in reaction, don't you think?
Yeah, but what if the person trying, you know, I guess, what if the person trying to make the point has a valid point and the other person is really just being a jerk?
Okay, so what if the person has a valid point? There's better ways to say it than bludgeoning somebody. There are better ways to say it, and what we want to get people to do is communicate whatever they need to communicate, but say it in a way that you're heard. Say it in a way that it has some kind of redeeming value to the discussion. Only then will you move the discussion along. So you just have to say it in a different way. So, for instance, you're the meanest person in the world, Tamara, and everybody knows it, and I'm your husband, and we're going to get divorced. So maybe you've been a substance abuser, a terrible mother, you've spent all of my money. Instead of saying, you're the worst person I know, I hate you, this is terrible, you're a bad mother, you could just say, I really wish this relationship could have worked out. I really wanted it to work out. But I'm not able to participate in a relationship where I'm the parent most of the time with the kids. I'm the one more financially responsible. That's a different way of communicating, Tamara, that you really have done this relationship wrong. It takes a lot of restraint to talk like that, but it's the best way to do it. How does that sound? Does that sound? I mean, I've watched this happen in front of me like magic. I've watched this happen because when I'm in the mediations, I stop people. I literally stop people from talking poorly to one another. Or when I start the mediations, here's what I say to people. Okay, things have happened. They're irreparable. You have decided to get a divorce, done and over with. Now these are just the logistical steps to get you to that point. You're not axe murderers. You are just fallible people who in this relationship couldn't sustain it. You are people that have to change your behavior, some more than others. Mm-hmm. But this isn't punishable by prison. So let's keep this in context, that we must forgive each other. We must be understanding to a certain point. And then we go ahead and live our lives without each other because this is the healthiest way. But nobody's committing a crime here by being less than perfect people.
Well, and how much do you find is perception on each of the person's part of what the problems are within the marriage that got them to the point of divorce?
I kind of think everybody knows and is pretty accurate why they're getting divorced. At least they know why they're divorcing their mates. Maybe a little bit more light should be shed on yourself, maybe a little bit more self-reflection. But I think we internally know when we haven't done our jobs either. We're just reluctant to admit it, because to admit it means two things. To admit it means to admit that the other person isn't the worst person and completely to blame, and to admit it means that we have to put it out there, I guess, that we have a few things to work on. So
okay.
It's hard to admit, but mm-hmm. I want to tell you something. It happens in mediation. If you as a mediator can get people to, first of all, speak from the heart. Remember the things we talked about last week. Speak from mm-hmm. the I position. Speak from only your position. Speak from how you're affected, the reaction you had. If you can just speak from that and stop saying you did this, you're to blame, you. If we can stop doing that, the whole conversation changes. Because then
and
the
if
other
you go through a traditional divorce, you might not ever have to have those kind of conversations.
If you have attorneys speak for you, you'll never have those conversations.
Yeah.
You never will. You'll never get to that point. And but you know what, Tamara? I mean, there are people that absolutely need attorneys. They absolutely can't even get to the point of even in a mediation having a conversation. Those are rare because I have even found in mediations where people can't sit in the same room, if you're a really good mediator, you can get people to put their guard down individually when you're talking to them, and you can ask them questions that will really force them to dig deep into their own set of behavior and thinking and logic and philosophies and principles. And once people can get to that point, everything changes, and they're ready to talk, and they're able to make deals and offer concessions.
So then do you have a checklist that you work through with the clients to get through the kind of practical aspect of the divorce?
Well, I think the checklists change a little bit. The first thing I do when I meet with any couple is I do say the same thing to everybody. Neither of you have committed a crime because you're getting divorced. Stop blaming yourselves. Stop blaming each other. Just stop the blame. It's unnecessary. It is a shame if you have children that the marriage wasn't happy, and so your children now are having to deal with it, and you get to spend less time with your children because you have to share time, but stop blaming each other. So that's the first thing I do with everybody. That's top of the checklist. Sometimes I even say to the couples, I would like you to start this discussion by complimenting each other. As much as you hate each other right now, or as much as you're distressed by each other, you still can find something redeeming about each other. So if the relationship is really toxic, if I really have never seen anything kind in phone conversations or emails come out of these people, I will force them to compliment each other. And it's really interesting how that works, because now they have to admit that this is not the worst person in the world and there is something redeeming about it. Plus, it's a graciousness coming out of you. If you can compliment somebody, you're being gracious, and that sets you up for maybe being a little bit more positive. But other than that, I typically spend enough time talking to people over the phone, or if they've already come to us for us to file their paperwork to get divorced, I know more about them, and so I know where to go, where to start, how to approach them, because I've talked to them already. But if I haven't, I do have to spend a little time asking about what they want to mediate, and maybe what their position is going to be, just so I know going into it where they're coming from. But I never assume I know where it's going, because I'm always pleasantly surprised. It's like Christmas. It's really fun once you get people to start talking to each other civilly. It's really fun to see where their negotiation can go. It's an interesting journey, and you have to allow people to go on that journey as they want to, and you can't stop them from making a decision that works for them that may not be the exact decision you've thought they were going to make, but you don't really know their backstory, so you do have to let them lead a little bit. If you see them making a decision that you know is impractical because you've seen it be impractical, like, for instance, child custody, huge, huge, huge issue. With child custody, you have to put a visitation plan together, and so you have all these different configurations of visitation plans, and you see the couple earnestly trying to work it out. I will offer what I've seen across the board be the best case visitation plan that people tell me works better than anything, or even kids say works better than anything, and not chopping the week up seems to be better than chopping the week up, but you do have to let people make their own decisions. But the communication just through the logistics, it's interesting to see where people break down. And it's interesting to see, for instance, with child visitation and custody, that 50-50 plan is the first thing people come in with. And they come in with it for two reasons. They want to show that they're an equally invested parent, which is great, and they want their amount of child support to be the least amount possible. And so the more time you are with your children, as the person paying support, the less money you spend, at least in California. But that's not always what supports the children best, and that's not always what your work schedule will allow you to do. And so just getting people to work through that communication and to show them that maybe spending time on the job and not pulling back on the job is the best way to support your children. And so, you know, you have to not worry about the percentage of time as much as you need to worry about how are you supporting your children's schedule. And that's a huge issue in mediation.
I would think an almost a fluid kind of thing, because you know, nothing's hard and fast with kids other than that it's going to change by the minute as they grow and go through different life stages. So what do you recommend for parents having worked out a mediation or a mediation kind of arrangement with child custody and then circumstances change? How do you address that on
early on by explaining to people that this is going to change and just get ready for it, that it's going to change. Because as good as it looks on paper right now, monkey wrenches will be thrown into the works. First of all, if both parents work, things are going to happen on the job. You're going to have to call the other parent and see if there's any way on first call of right of refusal, can they substitute for you. So you both have to set yourselves up for the flexibility that it requires. And then always have that third person available, whether it's paid childcare or one of the grandparents, a friend's parent. You really have to have your plan B and C's ready to go, because you're going to need them earlier than you think. And you just have to that's it. You just have to be ready for the flexibility. And even if you write something down in your mediation agreement, you just have to have a clause that, you know, this is in best case what's going to happen, but we both pledge to be flexible and treat each other with kindness when we have to change. But here you go. Here's where the fear comes in, and I get it. If we're not trusting of our partner to begin with, and that's why we're getting divorced, and maybe really bad on time, and we've seen them constantly come late to family events, and even in the interim period while we're getting separated and setting up different households, we've seen one parent come to pick up the kids late or not even call and not show up. I mean, people do awful things. We all hate to say it, but
yeah,
there are some people who should just never be parents. They just don't get it. I don't get the responsibility of being a parent, unfortunately, but here we are. You know, they are parents and they're part of the mix. It's tough. The parent who is more responsible is going to end up being more responsible, like it or not. But just please know your kids pay attention to that. Your kids know who the more responsible parent is. And although they want both parents to be in their lives, please know that they know who's doing more. They really do. But because they love both of their parents, they're accepting of the other parent, generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is who you had kids with, and it's not going to change.
Right.
But you're off the hook when they're 18 or when they're 21. There's a shelf life to the torment.
That's true. And then if you're not too tired to enjoy that, as I am finding out as my first year as an empty nester.
Is this your first year?
Yeah.
How does it feel?
It's just really been a transition year, because I had five kids and raised them by myself for last 15 years. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I hear everything you're saying.
Really, some of this did apply to your situation?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And so, what did you do? Make it better?
How could I or did I?
How did you? What were your best resources?
Oh, my family, incredibly supportive. So I had a team really behind me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was huge.
Good.
And then just, you know, and not that I made my mistakes, trust me, along the way.
It's called life.
Yeah.
Me too.
But I think I just hung in there. And my kids always knew that, you know, that we'd get through it. Not the best, but, you know, I think when you believe your kids are great kids, they will be great kids, you know, because you've given them that.
I think so, too. How was the communication with you? Did you have to learn how to change your communication to make the post-divorce better?
Well, I was taking notes as you were talking.
About not engaging?
No, I am the opposite of where I'm probably that blah.
Are you?
And then I just, because, you know, the quote comes to mind of the couple ones, the person who cares the less has the most control, and that the opposite of love is not hate, it's apathy. And so I think those are two really hard components of when you're trying to resolve conflict with someone who won't engage, and then it tends to get you frustrated, which isn't going to bring out the best person in you either. So,
right.
So what do you do with that? The expert, I ask.
Yeah, well, first of all, really two great points that I liked what you just wrote. So, but not engaging means you have to respond somehow, but not engaging in anger, not fueling the fire. So, for instance, I had a couple here for mediation last week. She makes a lot more money than he does, but he makes a great salary. And in most states, except for California, and in most cities other than L.A., what he makes would feed a family of five easily, owning a home, sending kids to college. She just makes a ridiculously extraordinary amount of money because of the business she's in. That's it. So you got two things, and then they have a child. So you have two things happening. You have he feels less than, because money is very gender specific. It's still the men make more money than the women world, although I can totally see that changing. And you want to see a caged animal? You look at a woman that makes more than a man, and a man asking for spousal support or alimony, you've got a class A fight on your hands, because the women aren't used to it. The men hate it, but they're beaten down with it. They're used to paying spousal support, alimony, not the women. So that becomes a very interesting battle.
Well, I would think, as you said, you're going to see that more and more.
You're seeing it more and more. I started seeing it in January of last year. Funny enough, it just started popping up more and more. Which makes a conversation about women's rights and how they're second-class citizens in the career market. I'm like, I don't know. In L.A., it's changing a lot.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the issue was there were a lot of put-downs in regards to her role as a mother, because when you make a lot of money, you're not in the house a lot. You don't make a lot of money and stay at home. Doesn't work
right.
Like that. When you make a lot of money, that means you're out working a lot, or the requirements of what this career is are beyond 9 to 5. So everybody, if you like the money coming in, you got to like the hours. If you don't like the hours, you have to agree that you have to cut back on the money, and people aren't willing to do that. So while you're married, it works fine. Now when you're getting divorced, all of a sudden that person is a bad parent, because they're making a lot of money and they're not home a lot. Well, that should have been dealt with before you had kids. Be that as it may. So what I saw her doing was using the language, how much is he going to take me for? I want to know how much you're going to take me for. I can't believe you're taking me for alimony or spousal support. But those two words, take me, you're taking me.
Mm-hmm.
So I separately had a conversation with her, and I said, look, I'm noticing that this is your position. It's very victimized, and you keep using this one phrase over and over again. He's not taking you for anything. Unless you go to a court, this is still a negotiation between both of you. He could say he wants whatever amount of money he wants. A, the law only allows for a certain amount of money, percentage, based on both of your incomes. And we have this thing called a disomaster in California. I don't think any other state has it, but it's a state calculation, and it's a set of criteria, and it's different for each couple. And when you plug in these numbers, and the biggest numbers are your gross monthly wages and the amount of time each parent is with the child, that will spew out child support, and that will spew out spousal support depending on the county that you live in. The calculation is slightly different. So I just said, look, because you make more money, you're now feeling victim to the fact that there's going to be an amount of money that is going to be paid to him for X amount of years. But this is all very negotiable unless you go to court and have a judge do it, and then, unfortunately, you just have to live with the judge's decision. And nobody knows what the judge is going to decide. No two judges make the same types of decisions. They really don't. So I just said, so you're as much in control as he is. You just don't know it right now. So, A, you need to get this language out. And number two, when he throws barbs at you, all you say is, I hear you, I hear you, I understand. I don't feel that way, but okay, I understand. And leave it alone. If he's not in the position to truly have a heart-to-heart about why he's saying it, and he may not even believe it. He may be just saying it, which I think was the case, because this was his way of showing that he's upset, he doesn't really want the divorce, you're the one that wants it, and this is his way of getting back. And generally you'll find the person who didn't want the divorce is the one throwing a few more barbs than the one who wants the divorce.
So that's, we'll take a question.
Pardon me?
We have a caller on the line if you'll take a question.
Oh, God, let's do it, yes.
Okay, all right. Heidi?
I love this.
Hi, yes, we have a caller on the line. Are you there, sir?
I am. My name is Mike. I'm recently divorced. And I just had a question for her. What does one do in a divorce situation where one spouse refuses to communicate and won't cooperate or go through mediation, and that leaves the other spouse only, the other spouse's only recourse really of hiring an attorney, which then can get expensive to get to any type of agreement worked out with the other spouse.
Mike, hi, this is Judy, and thank you for calling in. Mike, the big thing I would always go to is why. Why don't you want to have a conversation? Why don't you want to engage in mediation? That why will tell you a lot. So you know of a couple like this, or you experienced it when you were getting divorced?
I experienced it when I was going through a divorce.
Why didn't you?
I was all for mediation and to keep it out of the attorney's hands, so to say, because that's just adding costs and fees into their pockets.
So, but why didn't she want to go through mediation?
She couldn't find somebody that she trusted. She had her family attorney who was the one that was looking out for her best interest.
Okay. So she had fear. Is it right to say that she had fear over her own confidence that without an attorney, she would not be making the right decisions for herself?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, because I see that a lot as well. And I've seen these people eventually be brought to mediation because we allowed the attorney to be present. So was that ever an option, to conduct a mediation with the attorney sitting next to her, but maybe you by yourself, showing her that she had an extra layer of consultation or an extra layer of confidence sitting next to her?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. Because I think possibly, I mean, the hindsight is great, isn't it? I think possibly that if she were presented with this option, so, and presented this way, I do understand that you may not be confident that on your own you would not be making the best decisions for yourself. But to minimize the cost of this divorce and to allow you to feel as confident as possible, I would be willing to do a mediation with your attorney sitting next to you, as long as, you know, really as long as we can keep it civil. And they, some attorneys think that not being civil is the way to represent their client, and other attorneys get that being civil is the better way. It still means you can ask for what you want. You just ask for it in a nicer way, that's all. But I kind of think that, and if anybody else is going through this who is listening, really focus on the why and see if you can satisfy the why in a way that's a compromise that will, A, achieve your goals, Mike, and that is let's spend the least amount of money we can so that we can keep the money between ourselves, but also put it, have it in such a way that we still don't throw it open to a judge. So let me ask you, did you end up going to court, or did you also have to hire an attorney, and your attorneys just eventually were able to, through both of you, get an agreement?
Yeah, I ended up having to hire an attorney and go into court and draw it out even longer.
Oh, did you actually get in front of a judge?
Yes.
And that's a shame. I'm so sorry. How did you feel about the decisions the judge made on the salient points of your divorce?
I was happy with it. It was kind of a reverse situation, too, where I was kind of the stay-at-home dad, and she was the one traveling and was the main moneymaker, and wasn't sure how that was going to go over.
And how did it work out? Do you still have minor children?
No, they're over 18 now.
Okay. So how did it work out then? Did you end up being the stay-at-home dad?
I did, yes. I was able to do that for at least until she was 18, and get supported through maintenance and support that way.
And then was the decision of the judge a little bit more in favor of, I don't want to say in favor of you, but did she end up spending a little bit more money on child support and alimony than she had originally thought or wanted?
Yeah.
And isn't this funny? So she's making more money, therefore wants to be protective of it, right?
Correct.
And is mad at you that your salary isn't closer to hers? Is that kind of how
correct,
it went?
Correct. Plus, her thinking was, I could just go out and get a job, and I've got a college education, and that there's nothing preventing me from going out and doing that.
Okay.
You know, Judy, that brings up a question I wanted to ask before our caller called in. So, you know, a good point here of whichever spouse ends up having the more successful career, making the more money, I think comes out of a team partnership in the early years of that marriage, in those formative career years, especially as kids come into the picture, because one parent can't be gone and invested to the degree that it takes to build a successful career, whether it's the mom or the dad, and then not have the other person supporting that at home with the primary caretaker. But because our society doesn't value that primary caretaker role and there isn't a monetary number, you know, attachment to that, then you get divorced and it's like, you know, okay, I'm, you know, I don't want to share my money because it's my job, my career, but not appreciating or valuing the sacrifice and or the career options that the other person had to give up, and then how do you take back time to rebuild a career now that you're in a divorce situation?
And that's what makes spousal support, or in most states, alimony, the most difficult line item to deal with in a divorce for every single reason that you said. You make a decision, both parents, to, if you can afford it, for one person to stay home and the other person to work. And so it works beautifully until you're ready to get divorced, and then all of a sudden the person who stayed home, be it man or woman, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. The wage earner just expects that other person to leave the house, get a job, and support themselves. And it doesn't work like that. First of all, this society right now, our economy is so tough that people who used to be able to get jobs in a minute can't get jobs in a minute anymore. And so you do have to be retrained. The other thing is that although this is the hardest thing about being married, although it's not a business when you get married, the process of divorce treats the marriage like a business. And it's all about money. And we're not set up to look at it like that when we're getting divorced because we didn't look at it like that when we were getting married. And there's a word that nobody has used yet this morning that comes up constantly in divorce, and that's the word entitlement when it comes to spousal support, alimony. And that is the person who makes less or has not had a career because they've stayed at home, they say, I just want what's legally entitled. Oh, man, those are the hardest words for me to deal with because, first of all, and every lawyer, too, I will speak for most lawyers on this because when we have conversations about it, none of us know where to go because we know it's a huge gray area in divorce, and those have the biggest fighting words included in them. I mean, other than dividing up the children. I guess they may have some of the strongest language attached. But then comes spousal support and alimony. And so the words legally entitled, they leave us nowhere. And if you're going to have to change your communication to deal with spousal support, I beg you to do that. Because I wanted to, if you're in the state of California, the spousal support seminar I attended, sponsored by the Los Angeles County Bar Association in June of last year, and it was packed with attorneys. I was probably one of the only non-attorneys in the room. I was in shock. There were five judges on the panel, and all five judges talked about how they ruled on spousal support, and no two judges said the same thing. Isn't that shocking?
That is
shocking.
I think at some point
I just said, I wish all of my clients could be sitting here in this room to find out that if you think by going to court you're going to, quote-unquote, get your day in court and get what's legally entitled to you, nobody knows what that is anymore. Here's how people decide in California. First of all, if somebody has not been working for a while, rest assured for some years, for several years, they're going to get some type of spousal support. Has to be. But there's going to be a shelf life to it. Even in a long-term marriage where the people are still of working age. So if you're getting divorced in your 40s and you've been at home since your mid-20s raising kids. Unfortunately, you're still of the age where you can get qualified to do something. If you're in your late 50s and early 60s, that gap has narrowed. It's going to take you longer to get into the job market, and it's going to take you some time to get your skills together. So the way spousal support is being looked at in a broad sense in the state of California is how old are you? What is your level of need being financial need? Do you already work maybe with a part-time job, or do you not work at all? What's your educational level? How long is it going to take you to get in the job market? Because if you have minor children, you're going to be expected to get in the job market. You just are, because it's the only way to support your kids the best way you can. Everybody knows in California that unless you are mega, mega, mega wealthy people, multi-million dollars, and we don't all make multi-million here in California, but we still have a very high standard of living. Everybody knows that it's going to take two incomes to support the kids properly. It just is. So I really caution people to do whatever you have to do, roll up your sleeves, make a deal with each other that works for both of you, because your standard of living is going to change. Even the higher wage earner, your standard of living is going to change. There's no such thing as maintaining the marital standard of living. It's illogical. Whoever thought of that phrase probably didn't get the best night's sleep the night before it went into the legislature, because it doesn't make sense. So please don't think that your day in court is going to do what you think it's going to do. It probably won't, and only rarely will it. So even more, you must have a conversation. So let's go back to before Mike called. How do you really do that on the big ticket items? Don't engage in angry words. Truly listen to what your spouse is saying, and try and be, and when you talk, just talk from the heart. Just really communicate honestly how you feel and why you feel that way, and certainly be open to maybe your spouse sees the situation differently than you do, and maybe you just have to agree to disagree in order to come to some type of compromise. But
and then is that where kind of some of those pragmatics of the law and what it's going to be, you know, X, Y is going to be Z?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And you know what I'm starting to do in my mediations, by the way, just to put in the pragmatism of the law, or at least the extent that people have seen the law applied. Since I'm a non-attorney mediator, I have limits to what I can do and say about quoting law. I really do have limits. So I am forced to go pragmatically, which, by the way, is the best way ever, is to go pragmatically, because when you go pragmatically, you work your resolution out to suit your particular situation. And everybody's situation is slightly different. But what I've started doing recently is asking couples if they would like an attorney to just sit in the mediation, an attorney who already knows that person cannot represent either party if the wheels come off the mediation and they want to litigate. So they get that. But they're only there to provide the legal reference, so that the parties, unrepresented by attorneys, can then say, okay, we hear this. We hear how judges have made decisions. We hear what you've said about how the law has been applied. And then they go back to each other, and they turn to each other, and they say, okay, well, based on that, how does this sound to you? And then they move forward, and they work their negotiation based on what they've heard the attorney just say. And that may be, it's a new business model that I kind of like, or a new mediation model that I like.
I can see the value of that, because that neutrality, but yet, you know, when someone says, you can go fight this out in court, but it's all going to come down to what the law says anyway. That has a way to cutting to the chase, I would think.
Yes, or it all comes down to what your particular judge feels about the law and how they feel that day when they come to court. See, this is something nobody talks about because it would pull the Band-Aid or pull the screen, the veil off the court of law. This is what nobody will talk about unless they have worked inside of law, and that is judges are people too.
Mm-hmm.
And judges make bad decisions at times, really bad decisions. That's why we have appeals court.
Right. And that your day in court doesn't mean it's going to go
right.
be decided in court. A lot of it is already determined before you even step foot in the courthouse, so that's where you get your ducks in a row ahead of time.
Yes. But also, Tamara, I mean, listen to this. You know, a judge, be it male or female person, could just have had an argument with their spouse. Maybe they're going through a divorce. Maybe they've just come out of a nasty divorce. How do you think they're going to feel if maybe one of you litigants sitting across from them reminds them of their spouse? Do you
and
think
not well.
In your favor? This is the human nature of the people making decisions for you in law.
Mm-hmm.
They can sometimes make prejudicial decisions, not meaning to, but they're human beings. They make mistakes. They rule from feelings. And now what we're having in family law, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm going to give it to you in a second. Do you
yes.
know the changeover in judges and personnel in our courtrooms due to finances are putting people in positions that have no family law experience and don't know family law and are making rulings against the statutes and family codes?
See, that's like asking your foot doctor to do LASIK surgery on your eye.
It's happening. It's really happening. And what were you going to say? I interrupted you.
Well, because we're quickly running out of time here, but I just wanted to ask two quick questions. One, if mediation has to be cooperative, right? The other spouse has to be willing. So how do you get an uncooperative spouse there, or is your only option then going to court and serving a subpoena or, you know, whatever it is that they do
yeah,
in court? Come and appear.
Yeah, you can't, typically can't, you know, force anybody to go to mediation. Mediation is a process where even if you are completely disagreeing with each other, you want to use this option more than you want to use a courtroom. So, yes, you have to want to do it. There are people that will agree to come to mediation even though they really don't believe in it. They may never have had an experience with it. But they also realize they don't want to spend extraordinary money or don't want to have as their only option somebody who doesn't know them and has to make a decision in 20 minutes. Basically, you don't get much time in court anymore. And
right.
you don't get your whole case heard at one time either, I'm told. So, yeah, you kind of have to want to participate. But here's what I see. I mean, to your point, you have people agreeing to come to mediation thinking the mediator will figure out that my spouse is the one who's really wrong, and I just want one other person to see that, and then that person will tell us how to make our decisions. It doesn't work like that.
That's not your role.
No, the only way to do this is to really start communicating effectively, start asking people, like to Mike the caller, and I'm so appreciative that he called in. When you find there's a resistance in the other person, ask why. Just simply ask why. And then listen to why and see if you can provide a remedy for that. The why question is so important. Assuming you know why is wrong, because I'll tell you, Tamara, that when I've really said to my participants in a mediation, please don't interrupt, let me ask why, let me get to the bottom of this for you, because I think I'm going to ask questions that you've never asked, and when they allow me to do that, they are so surprised to find out what they assumed was the issue is not really the issue. But they've just never let the conversation get to that point.
Right, and that goes back to our conversation last week, so I'd really encourage any of our listeners who maybe missed that to go back first and listen to last week's, because it really does lay the groundwork of those communication points, and a little plug for our show. But really, it sets up today's conversation well. And then just really quick, and then we're about out of time here, actually over, the cost difference, I mean, what ballpark? And you don't have to, because I know each case is specific, but what does a couple stand to gain or not lose going through a mediation process versus court?
Okay. So going through court means you've had a lot of attorney time invested before you even get to the courtroom. And so what does that equal in terms of money? What I hear is that most people are not going to get out of a divorce under $20,000, and I'm talking about $20,000 per person. You may go in paying a $5,000 retainer. That gets eaten up really, really, really fast because all the court forms, all the filing, all the serving on each other, that's eaten up before you know it, before you even get into the negotiations. That's eaten up. Then if the spouse has an attorney that wants to rack up attorney fees or make it more difficult and aggravating, they'll just start doing things that they won't respond, or they're not allowed to play tricks. I mean, actually, ethically, they're not allowed to do it, but, you know, what you see is not always proper behavior. So you're looking at the very minimum of $20,000. I've seen it go well into $100,000, well into.
That's crazy.
My girlfriend just spent $65,000. She literally had to get an attorney because there was so much deceit and there was so much money on the table, and she could not get her soon-to-be ex to communicate in any way, shape, or form. But she also didn't know about her options. She actually only knew about attorneys, and I didn't know. We hadn't spoken in several years. I didn't even know she was going through a divorce, so it obviously wasn't my best. But it was a friend through business, and we had socialized. So she got $300,000 in her settlement because he was a very wealthy man, but she spent $5,000 to do it. And he fortunately caved before it went to court. I don't know what his attorney's fees were. It had to have been at least $65,000. If hers was $65,000, his had to be $65,000 at least. So you're talking about $100,000 on attorney's fees. Most people don't have that much to gain. Most are of average means. And I've still seen people run up over $100,000. Now, let's look at mediation cost. Mediation costs are anything from low end, at least in California, low end of, oh golly, I charge $175 for people who already, $175 per hour, for people who are already using me to file all their court documents. I charge $250 per hour if you're only going to use me as a mediator. That is rare that an attorney turned mediator only bills $250 an hour. Most attorneys who turn mediator are billing $400 an hour.
Right.
And for mediation. They're billing their same hourly rates.
Right. They're just taking it in a different context and billing.
But
format.
The participants are the ones who regulate the amount of time taken in a mediation. And that's why I think mediation is still the better way to go. Because you, the participants, are the ones determining what the outcome is. You can guide the mediator in terms of how much time you want to spend on any particular topic. And so, therefore, you can regulate how much you're actually going to spend. Now, there are some mediators, and they're generally attorney mediators, who give you these packages. They'll give you $2,800, and this will be unlimited mediation or get you X number of hours of mediation. So you do have to investigate. The field of mediation is growing, and so therefore the business model of how to present your mediation company is actually changing too.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. I appreciate you sharing that. And if someone wanted to get in touch with you or have more questions or get some information on what their options are, how would they do that?
Our phone number is 310-441-7555, 310-441-7555, or our website, adivorceresource.com, adivorceresource.com.
And I will put that information up on our Link Local Network website. Actually, it's already up there from last week. So if you go to our blogs, I have the both links for the shows and then your contact information on that blog post so people can find you there and link through.
And I already had contacted my web person last week, and I said, let's get this on the homepage of the website, and then we're going to do part two. So that and then there's articles I've written, and there's books I recommend that would be great. Yeah.
Well, perfect. I thank you so much, Judy, for all of your time and wealth of information here, just both on conflict resolution and using mediation, and then specifically when it comes to divorce. I think it can really alleviate a lot of the stress of it when you look at it, as you said, pragmatically and just, okay, what's it going to cost for each of us to move on with our lives and have a fresh start?
And just stop arguing. It's so not worth it. It's just not worth it. Who cares what the arguments are? You're done.
Right.
You're getting divorced. Move on. Really. I mean, at the end of the day, move on.
Move on. So we will move on to the end of the
show. On. Move on and trend on.
Thank you so much. I look forward to staying in touch. So
thank you so much. Thank you for the listening.
You're welcome. All right. And for this week's quick Tamerlay's trend on fashion, I stood in line at a coffee shop the other day, and a woman was excitedly sharing about her spotting a small patch of new grass trying to make its way out from what was our heavy snow and how green it was. And, you know, last month was St. Patrick's Day. We talked about green. But just so exciting. There's something invigorating and inspiring about green at this time of the year when we're all sick of winter. Maybe in California they don't know what that's like. They'd have a hard time relating to Kermit of it's tough being green. But shades of spring greens illuminate like sunshine. And so using green in your wardrobe, especially paired with whites, I love that how the white will act like white woodwork and framing in white. That looks so fresh. And then interiors, if you take a cue from interior design of pairing a color up against that white, green works especially well. And spring green is Taliesin, architect Frank Lloyd Wright here in Wisconsin, and he was great about kind of incorporating outside space, the environment, with his inspiring works of architecture. And for fashion, you can take kind of those same cues of how to use green in springtime to illuminate everything you wear as it is infused with sunshine. As Pantone, the LLC, the color definitive authority, talks about how using color as a language, looking at color as a language in this multidisciplined color forecast highlights the key palettes for women's wear, men's wear, active wear, cosmetics, and lifestyle. And we can look to industrial and graphic design of how they use green in those. And Frank Lloyd Wright, one of his favorite quotes was, "Give me luxuries of life and I will gladly do without the necessities." And that's never more true when it comes to fashion. And so if you look at the luxury of wearing green, it's special because it evokes a happiness and energy, a lightheartedness. So get in light of yesterday being Earth Day, who was also founded by Gaylor Nelson, a Wisconsin native, we want to inspire earth greens and shades to wear in your spring wardrobe. And I will put more of that on my website, too, on TamerlayLLC.com, trend on blog. So next week, we invite you back for Trend On. We will be having our guest, Steve Jenkins. He is the president at Fond du Lac County Economic Development and Corporation. So we're going to kind of go back to a more business focus and how he sees the challenges of the recession restarting and moving forward out of that as opportunity and not a challenge. So we will look forward to his expertise in the area of business and insight on making opportunities happen in our current economic climate. And that will be next week on Tamara Lee's Trend On. We are live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Link Local Network. We'll see you next week, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.